This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 26, 2007, from KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. Turkish jets continue raids into Iraqi Kurdistan, and regional authorities say innocent people have been killed. Serbia moves to cut diplomatic ties with the EU and the US if Kosovo's independence is recognized. And we'll take a look at South Korea's soaring suicide rate and what's being done to curb it. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Two European diplomats have been ordered to leave Afghanistan amid accusations that the two were engaging in improper talks with the Taliban. One of the men is an Irish national representing the European Union. The other is a Briton with a high-level position within the United Nations Assistance Mission. A UN spokesman said the men had met with tribal elders, local authorities, and people from different political backgrounds in the recently recovered city of Musa Qala in the volatile Helmand province. The expulsion orders are the first issued to Western diplomats since the U.S.-led invasion brought Hamid Karzai to power. An independent radio station in Mogadishu has become the latest casualty of media restrictions in Somalia, Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports.
The privately owned Somali One Radio is off the air today after the mayor of Mogadishu ordered the station to shut down. Somali One Radio staffers said the mayor issued the orders over the phone after a station aired an interview with an exiled member of the deposed Islamic Courts Union. The National Union of Somali Journalists has condemned the action, as has Reporters Without Borders. Somali media has been working under stiff restrictions since the transitional government returned to power with the assistance of Ethiopian military action. The Committee to Protect Journalists is now ranking Somalia as second only to Iraq as the deadliest country in which to work as a journalist. Seven reporters have been killed this year in Somalia, most of them worked in radio. Mohammed Sheikh Noor, FSRN, Mogadishu.
Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez says that Colombia's FARC guerrillas are ready to release three hostages into his custody. Chavez says he has aircraft on standby to pick up the two women and the infant as soon as the Colombian government authorizes the operation. The Venezuelan president had been mediating talks between the rebels and the government before the Colombian president abruptly suspended Chavez's role. In other news, the FBI is set to award a $1 billion contract to amass the world's largest database of biometric information. This, according to a recent Washington Post report. Kelly Ramirez has more.
The project, called Next Generation Identification, is a 10-year effort to gather iris scans, scars, and face shape information, as well as fingerprints and palm prints. According to the FBI, the new database will make identification of criminals and terrorism suspects faster and easier because the accuracy of identification is improved when techniques are combined. But currently, the National Crime Information Center database is exempt from the Privacy Act requirement that records be accurate. FBI officials have claimed that in law enforcement data collection, quote, it is impossible to determine in advance what information is accurate, relevant, timely, and complete, unquote. Preventing identity theft could also be more difficult with biometrics. If someone steals your credit card, you can cancel it and get a new one with a new account number. But if someone steals your iris scan, you cannot cancel your eyeballs and get new ones. For FSRN, I'm Kelly Ramirez.
Scores of people are missing or dead after heavy rains triggered landslides on Indonesia's Java Island. Chad Burchard reports from Jakarta.
Monsoon rains caused mudslides and severe flooding during the night as residents slept. In the hardest hit area, residents and rescue workers combed through the debris with their hands in search of victims. Key roads into affected areas about 300 miles east of the capital are blocked. Days of torrential rain have caused rivers to overflow their banks across Indonesia, inundating tens of thousands of homes. Landslides are frequent in Indonesia, where years of deforestation have left many hillsides with little vegetation to hold the soil. In December last year, flooding and landslides killed more than 100 people and drove an estimated 100,000 more from their homes in North Sumatra Island. For Free Speech Radio, I'm Chad Bouchard in Jakarta.
And finally, Nepal's main political parties have reached an agreement with Maoist rebels to abolish the monarchy. The demand had become the main condition for the demobilization of the decade-long Maoist insurgency. A deal signed on Sunday will require King Gyanendra to step down, along with the election of a constituent assembly to rewrite Nepal's constitution. Elections are expected in the first half of 2008, although a firm timetable has not yet been established. Those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Turkish jets launched fresh attacks across the border into Iraqi Kurdistan. Today's bombing of 8 PKK bases adds to Turkey's military claims of more than 200 targets hit by airstrikes and 175 Kurdish guerrillas killed as a result of the raids. Al Jazeera is reporting confirmation of the attacks by Iraqi Kurdish forces, but not the number of Kurdish fighters killed. Turkey's military says the raids that started on the 16th of December left no civilians harmed. However, both Turkish authorities and international bodies, including the United Nations, report that many families had to flee their villages and a civilian woman was killed in the raids. Kurdish regional authority in northern Iraq, Mesud Barzani, condemned the Kurdish raids and charges that innocent people have been killed. Ozgur Baris has more from Ankara.
Turkey's cross-border strikes were triggered by the deaths of 12 Turkish soldiers this October in the attacks by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. A cross-border military operation had been approved by the Turkish parliament in October. Turkey says the PKK uses its bases in northern Iraq to launch attacks on Turkey, and the country has a legitimate right to protect itself. However, the operations have only brought instability and insecurity to both sides of the border. Hüseyin Öntaş is an activist from the Durde campaign against nationalism and racism.
Turkey has previously made a number of cross-border military operations, but they had no effect. We do not think that the solution to the problem lies in military operations. There is need for more general social and judicial solutions to the problem. Especially in the fields of human rights, there is need for more fair access to rights and better implementation.
Since 1984, nearly 37,000 people have died, while hundreds of thousands of Kurds have been displaced as a result of the war between Turkey and the PKK. Domestically, the recent attacks by PKK aroused a nationalistic reaction within Turkey against the pro-Kurdish Democratic Society party that defends negotiations between the Turkish government and the PKK. Şerafettin Halis is an elected representative from the Democratic Society party. He talks about the recent pressures on the party, such as the arrest of the party leader Nurettin Demirtaş, because he allegedly used a false medical report to avoid military service.
Even before we were elected in the parliament, there were pressures on our party, and this continued after we were elected. But we continue our struggle to use the democratic ways. Instead of oppressing us, the Turkish state should see the Democratic Society Party as a chance for a democratic solution to the Kurdish problem. This would be better for the democratization in Turkey.
The United States had previously tried to convince Turkey to pursue diplomatic solutions with the PKK, fearing that the only relatively stable region of Iraq would also fall into a continuous state of conflict. However, last month, Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan's visit to Washington, D.C. was concluded with a promise by the U.S. to share its intelligence on PKK, several news agencies such as Reuters reported. On Monday, Washington's national security spokesman Gordon Jondrow affirmed that President George W. Bush's support for Turkey's cross-border operation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Özgür Barış from Ankara, Turkey.
Kosovo's newly elected government is likely to unilaterally declare independence in line with recommendations of a report submitted to the UN Secretary General this month. The Serbian parliament is debating a resolution today to cut diplomatic ties with the EU and the US if a declaration of independence by its breakaway province is recognized. Amy Miller reports from Belgrade.
The latest in the series of negotiations between Serbian and Kosovar representatives reached no agreement. Leaders of the Kosovar-Albanian majority remain committed to independence, Serbian leaders equally against it. Igor Todorovic, editor of Pregledni Pregled, a Belgrade-based daily, comments on the deadlock situation at the closure of the 18-month Troika group designed to come up with concrete solutions.
The biggest problem was that there have been signals from the American administration that even if negotiations fail, even if there is no agreement on the future status of Kosovo between Serbian authorities and the interim institutions of Kosovo, the representatives of Kosovar Albanians, the United States would still recognize Kosovo independent.
Kosovo independence is an imminent reality now that Kosovo's future prime minister, Hashim Thaci, the former head of the KLA, a guerrilla army-turned-political party and a man heavily implicated in organized crime in the region, has given public indication that he will declare unilateral independence. Some in Serbia fear another war could be around the corner. Defense Minister of Serbia, Dragan Šutanovac, responds to this reaction.
Absolutely everyone assured us that they will do everything in their power to prevent and stop any provocation and escalation of violence. We still have strong contact with them, and that assurances they gave us by very serious people help us to dedicate ourselves more to south of Serbia, and that on issue of Kosovo and Metohija, we are in safe hands.
Thaci, made bolder by U.S. and EU support, Serbia cannot be so certain its backer, Russia, will stand by it. Todorovic explains that Serbia's political elite are using the conflict to their advantage, knowing there will be a Serbian leadership presidential election next month.
By making the Kosovo issue so filling the headlines so much, it means that they neglect other problems that they actually have the authority and the power to solve. So they are occupying themselves with rhetorics on Kosovo and what happens there, even though they have no authority over Kosovo.
Serbia currently faces 50% unemployment rate, and the average income remains 300 euros a month, with the economic woes being felt in every sphere of life. Serbia objects to the idea of Kosovo's independence and uses the threat of an economic blockade, knowing it would have severe repercussions to the new state. Vojadin Marinković, coordinator for national minorities, explains that there are other important internal issues.
The minority groups should certainly be considered by the Security Council so that they can claim the same rights. They suffered the same dislocation that the larger groups did. Romas went through the same treatment as Serbs. Many people don't know that their houses got burnt. Many of them went into exile. Many of them were killed. But it's not talked about, partially because these minorities have little communication with the outside world. But the truth is the Roma, the Turks, Ashkalije, and others went through, and are still going through the same suffering. Their rights are still endangered.
The Security Council meets on December 19th and will have a complex task to resolve opposing views, with veto-wielding Russia supporting Serbia, the U.S. backing independence, and the European Union yet to reach consensus on a course of action. From Belgrade, Serbia, this is Amy Miller for Free Speech Radio News.
No Serbian leader can expect to do well in January's elections if they're associated with the loss of the province of Kosovo. The European Union has offered to speed up Serbia's integration into the EU, perhaps hoping this would encourage Serbian Prime Minister Vojislav Kostunica to concede independence for Kosovo. But the resolution to reject membership in the EU and NATO, if Kosovo's independence is recognized, gained the support of both Kostunica's pro-Europe Democratic Party and the harder nationalist Democratic Party of Serbia. In just a few decades, South Korea transformed itself from a third-world country devastated by war into the world's 13th largest economy. But the fast pace of the so-called Korean miracle has a dark side, according to many mental health experts. South Korea now has the highest suicide rate in the developed world, and the number of those taking their own lives is steadily increasing. FSRN's Jason Strother is in Seoul, where he looks at the possible causes behind the rise and speaks with a group that's making suicide prevention its top priority.
On the platforms in many of Seoul's metro stations, ceiling-high glass gates open and close as passengers enter and exit the subway cars. These barricades were installed to prevent people from throwing themselves onto the paths of oncoming trains. Suicide is the fourth leading cause of death here in Korea. In a survey of the 30 nations in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, Korea tops the list with nearly 25 cases per 100,000 people. According to health experts, that breaks down to 35 suicides each day. Dr. Hong Kong Wee is a psychiatrist and president of the Korean Association for Suicide Prevention. He says that the high number of suicides in Korea is a new phenomenon. He believes that the nation's rapid economic growth has changed the way Koreans regard life.
The cultural value system has been something missing, like some internal value standard. We used to be very strong in Oriental culture, in Korean culture, but it's too much materialistic, too much achievement-oriented.
What's changed most, Hong says, is family structure. Before the economic miracle, multiple generations lived together in one home. Now, a Korean family might consist of only three or four individuals.
What it means is that the support system, social support system, has changed. Previously, very close-knit family, you know, mutually independent and helping each other. Now it's very independent, small family, and when things happen, you know, you have a very little support from other people.
Hong's association is privately run and receives little funding from the government. It trains parents, teachers, and other professionals to recognize the signs of someone who is suicidal. Suicide is the leading cause of death for Korean males aged 18 to 35. On the campus of Seoul's Chung-Ang University, students say they recognize that suicide is a real problem facing their generation.
There are so many pressures at university. There's a lot of competition. This makes people feel very helpless and lost.
Well, today many young people do computers very... They are not related with other people. They don't talk about deepest things inside, though.
The World Health Organization says that 90% of suicides worldwide are the result of mental disorders or depression. Dr. Daniel Fisher is a Massachusetts-based psychiatrist who was asked by the South Korean government to evaluate their psychiatric facilities.
And in general, I have found that both in Korea and in the United States, that Asian Americans are even more, there's even a heavier stigma about mental health issues than there is among non-Asian Americans. And I think that does increase susceptibility to suicide.
The Suicide Prevention Association says this taboo often prevents people from seeking professional help. Instead, many go online in search of others who also feel hopeless. And that's where the association carries out much of its work, shutting down suicide websites. Dr. Hong says that many Koreans form packs online and later meet to end their lives together.
The suicidal youngsters can get together through chat, and then really meet together and carry out. And also there is a, we call suicide site. They kind of really advertise. We have this kind of thing, we can sell you kind of thing. Method and maybe some, you know, drugs and so on. So we try to cut it.
Hong says his team identified and shut down around 600 suicide sites in 2006. Hundreds more were found this year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul, South Korea.
Transgender, intersex, and gender nonconforming people are routinely subject to abuses and violence in New York State men's prisons by correctional officers and fellow inmates. This according to a new report released by the Sylvia Rivera Law Project in New York City, which also examines the pervasive discrimination and police harassment faced by transgender people. Andalusia Knoll has more from New York.
It's War in Here proclaims the title of a new report that draws on interviews with imprisoned transgender people to document the widespread harassment, abuse, and violence that they experience inside state custody. Gabriel Arkells, a lawyer at the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, says that cycles of poverty lead to an overrepresentation of transgender and gender nonconforming people within the criminal justice system.
Trans people face such pervasive discrimination in our lives that we end up disproportionately poor and homeless and end up sort of subject to police surveillance for those reasons or forced to commit survival crimes. You know, if you can't get a job, got kicked out of school because of the clothes you're wearing, your family's rejecting you, you can't even find a homeless shelter that seems safe for you, then you're not left with a lot of options to support yourself.
In recent years, quote-unquote quality of life policies in New York City have seen a police crackdown on people of color, homeless, and low-income people, coupled with gentrification. Transgender people say that they are routinely accused of prostitution while walking down the street or arrested simply for hanging out. According to Gabriel Arkells, there are very few alternatives to incarceration for transgender people who are arrested.
Many of the alternatives to incarceration that are available to people generally aren't available to transgender people because trans people can only comply with a program if they dress according to their assigned sex at birth and not actually according to their gender identity. Also, they can be really unsafe. We worked with one person who was really raped in his court-mandated drug treatment, so he ended up running away, and then he gets sent to prison for not complying.
Interviewees in the War in Here report say that similar transphobic policies exist in New York correctional facilities. They say that as transgender women placed in men's facilities, their lives are threatened by correctional officers who repeatedly humiliate, rape, and assault inmates. Transgender inmates are frequently subject to abusive strip searches, unnecessary frisks, and exaggerated punishments. Mariah Lopez, an activist and advocate with the Strategic Transgender Alliance for Radical Reform, says that correctional officers' lack of respect for transgender women leads other inmates to copy the officers' behavior.
There are more increased instances of violence, sexual harassment, and assault and abuse from other inmates as well. One, just because that's the nature of society sometimes against trans people as well. And number two, they're perpetuating the example they see from the institution itself and that this person is invalid in their right to be treated decently because they're in here with me and they're not getting the respect that they would be afforded outside the jail anyway, and so therefore it must be okay.
The San Francisco-based Transgender Law Center says that sexual violence is an ever-present fact of life for far too many transgender prisoners. Earlier this year, Alexis Geraldo, a transgender woman, sued the California Department of Corrections for enabling her repeated assaults while she was incarcerated. Geraldo says that the agreement she signed at her conviction did not include assault.
Nowhere in this document did this say that I was going to be ridiculed and mocked by staff, being raped, being cut, beaten, tormented every night.
The report also cites lack of access to hormones and transition-related treatment as a severe problem. Mariah Lopez says that this can cause people to experience a wide range of mental problems, which can later lead to their reincarceration. She says that New York State prisons need to comply with the Transgender Rights Bill.
We wouldn't be placed in men's prisons anymore, or we would have a separate area for ourselves. Retraining of all the staff to make clear that someone's gender identity is their own preference and writing policies to support that in ways to hold staff accountable.
Gabriel Arkell added that no improvements can make prisons an ideal place for transgender people.
We also really believe that there's no such thing as truly safe prisons. It's an inherently violent system, and the best thing that we can do is to work to fight mass incarceration and to try to end some of the root causes of poverty and incarceration in our communities.
Authors of the Sylvia Rivera Law Project report hope that their research will be used to develop and implement policies and practices that will alleviate the violence and discrimination that transgender, intersex, and gender nonconforming people face both inside and outside New York State correctional facilities. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Andalusia Null in New York City.
And now, from his cell on Pennsylvania's death row, a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The power of black music. Music is far more than a multi-billion dollar business in the U.S. and around the world. It is far more than the stuff that comes out of your radio in an unending roll. For some people, music, the right music, can transform one's way of looking at the world and even change lives. By music, as you may have guessed, I'm not talking about bubblegum pop or rap. I'm talking about a music form that has been called classical, at least by black listeners, for generations. I speak of jazz. I speak specifically of the music of the late saxophonist John Coltrane, born 1926, died 1967, an adherent of the form that came to be called avant-garde, French for advance-garde or free-form jazz. In the 50s, he was a star player in the Miles Davis Quintet. Later, he would lead several groups, and when not zonked out high on heroin, would play such music as would move millions, even now, decades after his death. In San Francisco, a church stands today which has named the musician a saint of the African Orthodox Rite. This is the same church that was a religious branch of the Marcus Garvey Black Nationalist Movement of the early 20th century. At the St. John Will.i.am Coltrane African Orthodox Church, Archbishop Franzo Wayne King presides, and his appreciation of Coltrane's music may be shown as often by his preaching as by his playing of the saxophone in tribute to the saint. In a recent interview, Archbishop King explained that he heard Coltrane live in 1966 at a local club called the Jazz Workshop, where he and his girlfriend, soon-to-be wife Marina, got front-row seats. What they heard that evening almost literally blew him away. King would later explain the experience as his sound baptism. So taken was he by the power and beauty of Coltrane's music that he first organized a small congregation called the Yardbird Temple, named after the nickname of another famous sax player, Charlie Parker. In this initial gathering, Coltrane was worshipped as a god, and Parker was seen as a John the Baptist-type figure. Years later, when he joined the African Orthodox Church, Coltrane was demoted to saint. Today, people come from all around the world to visit the San Francisco church. The influence of Coltrane has also had far less spectacular but still meaningful impact on the lives of people during the 60s. As black revolutionary and later scholar Muhammad Ahmad, who worked with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Revolutionary Action Movement, and other such movements, would later write in his political autobiography, "We Will Return in the Whirlwind," music opened his mind to political ideas and possibilities. First was going to see Max Roach and Abby Lincoln present their Freedom Now suite at the National Convention of the NAACP, which was held in Philadelphia that year. I had been raised on jazz and had done my homework with Eddie Collier while listening to John Coltrane's Giant Steps. I had gone to the Newport Jazz Festival and was an avid fan of both Miles Davis and Cannonball Adderley. But this was the first time I had heard message music so direct for my generation. The Freedom Now suite immediately raised my political, cultural consciousness. It wouldn't be until a year later that I would listen to John Coltrane's My Favorite Things and become a Trainite until Train passed on in 1967. As Ahmad explained, music was a powerful social force that opened new ways of looking and thinking about and even living in the world. Music is more, much more, than a commodity. Free jazz of that period represented quite simply freedom in breaking away from the restraints of the past. This power of music must be recaptured to become a resource for a people who are still not free. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.